We are studying the book of Exodus. I'm in chapter 22 on page 63. And this is called Rules and Regulations, Part 2. We were studying these various 613 regulations, and we're not going to get all of them because Deuteronomy doesn't cover all of them. But all of them, you have to study them in Leviticus and partially in Numbers, but mostly Leviticus and Deuteronomy. You have to study all three books to get all 613. I don't know who the scribe was that sat down and counted them to give us that number, but it's whenever you read the biblical history, they keep coming up the same number. So the point is that we're studying some of those, and we talked last week about the fact that these were given to us by God. These came down from Sinai. These are not when Jesus was fussing at the Pharisees and the scribes because they were imposing man-made regulations on people. He wasn't talking about these 613. He was talking about the some 2,500 others that they had added to them. We'll read some more of these. Remember now, the Torah law, these regulations, precepts, principles, whatever. Whatever they are, these are given to us as a tutor to teach us how God thinks, acts, behaves, feels. We're supposed to extrapolate from these, what is true. So if he tells me not to steal a donkey, I should realize that also means I shouldn't steal a Toyota. There's a certain logical process. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall pay 5 oxen for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. If the thief is caught while breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there will be no blood guiltiness on his account. But if the sun has risen on him, then there shall be blood guiltiness on his account. He should surely make restitution. If he owns nothing, then he should be sold for...
I was reading this today and I was wondering, why is he not guilty in the daytime?
Because you're misreading it, and I'm going to explain it to you in just a minute.
Thank you.
Okay. But I appreciate that because it gives me those little moments I have to cut out of the tape, you know.
That's right.
Yeah. No, I understand. Actually, one of the things we're going to see here is when we get to when he's bringing this stuff up, you get this laundry list of stuff, and it's not always related to anything. He'll talk about one thing one minute, and the next sentence is about something else altogether different. So when we get down to the when you were reading this today, you weren't reading my notes.
No, I just read the Bible.
Yeah, well, see, if you read the Bible, then you'll get the word. If you read my notes, you'll get the understanding. But
you cut that out, too.
No, I'm not. You know, I'm not going to cut that out. I'll just leave the whole thing in. Stan.
All right.
But if the sun has risen on them, there shall be blood guiltiness on his account. He shall surely make restitution. If he owns nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. If what he stole is found alive in his possession, whether an ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall pay double. If a man lets a field or a vineyard be grazed bare, lets his animal loose so that it grazes in another man's field, he shall make restitution for the best of his own field and with the best of his own vineyard. Now, there's about 9 topics here. Okay? Theft and its penalties are addressed. There's all kinds of issues about theft here. Accidentally killing a thief who is caught in the act is not murder, but if you take his life the next day, then it's a premeditated capital offense. So if a guy's breaking in your house and you shoot him and he dies, that's fine. But if you go hunt him down the next day and kill him, now you've committed murder.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the point is, you've heard it said, it's sort of cynically, that if you shoot a guy coming in your house and his body falls outside, drag him in and tear your wife's nightgown in half and put a stick in his hands so that you can tell the police that your wife is in mortal danger and he was shot in the house. Because if you do, then you are not legally liable because you're trying to protect your wife's life and it was in the house. But if they find him... Huh?
In fear of your life.
Yeah, if they find him outside on the porch, then you shot him before he had a chance to really threaten you. Now you're in trouble. Now they get into this whole harangue about this. All right. So if you find the thief the next day, and he has your goods, then you take those goods back, and then there's some minor penalty to the thief. If he doesn't have your goods, then he makes restitution. But that's different than he's breaking in to take your goods and you shoot him while he's there. Okay? A thief must make restitution, and he can even be sold as a slave if he doesn't have the funds for restitution in order to get the money for the restitution. Grazing someone else's property is theft and requires restitution. Now, we had this little discussion in one of my classes because one of my classmates has a penchant for taking albums down and copying them and, you know, whatever. And there's this issue today about the rights of the artist. And so, you know, can you take... if I buy a set of Microsoft Office, I'm allowed to put it on my computer at home and my computer at work, but I'm not allowed to stick it on Nancy's computer and your computer, and I can't go to each of your houses and stick a copy on each one of those. To do so is theft, but it's commonly considered fair play in our world today. If I hear if somebody's got an album that I like and I take it home and burn a copy, you know, we don't think anything of that, but that's theft. In this day, Moses couldn't say to them, if you burn a copy of someone else's tape, it is theft. Because, of course, Moses wouldn't know anything about burning a copy of a tape. But we're supposed to understand that. So,
in our law today, if somebody, again, steals your television, and 2 days later you find out who it is, there's your television, so you can get it back. He's still a thief, and he goes to trial.
There's still a penalty, but the point is it isn't to take his life. And if you get your television back, you got your television back. But if you don't, then he has to make financial restitution. In other words, you can bring a civil charge for penalties and damages and all kinds of stuff. But this is typical tort law. Even overgrazing one's own field is a crime because you are damaging the field, which damages people coming after you. This can result in erosion and the flooding of one's neighbor. So we're required to steward the earth, even what we consider ours. We're required to steward it. Remember that they were told to let the fields lie fallow every 7 years. You can imagine a lot of people ignored that. And then the result was that the land got all burnt out and was no use. When we talked about American Revival, one of the things we talked about that happened in New England was once the Puritan descendants quit lying their fields fallow every 7 years, the land got to be useless. And that was one of the reasons people picked up and moved west, because it would no longer sustain the people. You know, there's simple little things like you're supposed to rotate your crops so that you don't just jerk all of one kind of nutrient out of this and never replenish it. So if you go from corn to tobacco or to root plants or whatever, you wind up basically recycling what the land needs, and you take out different stuff in each planting. I'm not a scholar on what that is, but it's true.
When the people were in exile, like during Jeremiah's time in Ezekiel, it's like the land like fallow.
That's right.
It's like to
the reason they were in is they were in the reason they were in Babylon for 70 years was it was to make up for the seventh year that they skipped over the 490-year period. In other words, the land lie fallow. Because they wouldn't let the land lie fallow, God made it lie fallow for those number of years. There's a poetic justice in it. But the 70 years, he says, was for the years that they didn't let it lie fallow. So they wouldn't obey him, and so he made them obey him by hauling them off into captivity. So, yeah, these rules came down from God, and he's serious about that. We have environmental responsibility to the earth. We have stewardship responsibilities to the community. A man who plants a windborne weed is liable, as is a man who introduces kudzu-like plants is liable. So what we're seeing here is this conversation on stealing, and it covers a lot of different aspects of the stealing. It covers damages above and beyond what was stolen, or punitive damages. It covers the penalty being in measure with the crime. It talks about the kinds of theft that are not just I go take your lawnmower kind of theft, but the kind of theft where I take your good name, or I strip the land, or all these things are considered theft. They're all considered misprision of property and bad stewardship. Bad stewardship. So that's what these verses mean. Does that help stand? I mean, it's a, so it's
now, I think I read that initially, like the thief was trying to break in during the daytime.
Yeah, I know. And well, that's fair. You know, the truth is we're dealing with something that was written in Hebrew.
Yeah.
And I was telling Nancy the other day, she was talking about. Nancy is fond of chastising me to make things shorter, summarize more, and it's fair. It's fair. I'm verbose, and I sometimes would rather over-explain than under-explain. It's fair. But she was trying to shorten something up and found out she couldn't because there was just too much rich stuff in there. She couldn't. It was saying like she's trying to summarize Ezekiel into 16 weeks, and I'm going, "Rot's a ruck, baby." You know, well. The Bible is written extremely concisely, particularly the Old Testament. So when you think about it, you can be told a story that takes hours and hours and hours to do on a movie, and it's actually in four paragraphs in the Bible. If you really look at the Bible, in fact, when you see repetition, you need to realize that repetition is there for a very specific reason. It's there for emphasis. Otherwise, they wouldn't repeat it. Or it can indicate that the letters of Ezekiel or Isaiah were a sermon, and another sermon, and another sermon. And the reason there's repetition is because he needed to make the same point in each sermon. And then they were stitched together as if they were one long book. Those are things that you can understand about the Scripture. But when you look at the stories that are told, they're very tightly written. They're not wasted a lot. So when we're reading things like this, we're reading something that is basically a summary when it was written. And so what we have to do is to unpack it. We have to unpack it, and we have to inform it, as they would say, with cultural understanding, with understanding from other places in the Scripture. Every once in a while you have to go, now God would not say that, so what does this mean? In other words, the way I'm reading it does not sound like, God wouldn't say that I should hate my mother and my father. I know it says that, but that's not what God would never say that. So what does that say to me? I have two conclusions. God's an idiot, or I'm not getting this right, okay? Now, the first one's the one most of us run to. God's an idiot. I mean, we got a whole society saying, the Bible's full of junk. God's an idiot, you know? I mean, he contradicts himself all over the place. Well, I'm here to tell you, God does not contradict himself. And if something looks like it's contradictory, we have two choices. We can either believe that God's an idiot, or else I'm not reading this right. I'm not getting the distinction he's trying to make. We have to go to context and culture to understand why these things seem to conflict with each other. So whenever I see, like I've told this before, when disaster strikes my life, I used to say, "What the heck are you doing, God?" And I've learned after many years of, you know, apologizing for that. You know, after a while, you just get tired of saying, "I'm sorry," and you just quit doing what it is, you know. So now what I say is, "What are you doing, God?" In other words, obviously you're up to something. I can't figure out what it is, but I'm not going to call you a jerk this time. So, you know, please tell me what it is you're doing. And, you know, it's not because I'm a great man of God to do this. I'm just tired of apologizing. You know what I'm saying? I'm just, after a while, it's just kind of like, well, okay, I'll get mad, throw a fit, and crash some plates and all this other stuff, but I'm just going to be going saying I'm sorry. I mean, one of the things, Scott Grissett, my son-in-law, had a sermon at a Bible study we used to have at work one day about how the Bible tells us we're not supposed to take an offense at other people. And he actually put some scripture together that said that, and I thought, holy cow, we're not supposed to get offended by other people. But it goes sort of like this, okay? Now, you can get offended by other people if you want to, okay? But then you're going to have to forgive them, right? You're going to have to forgive them. And so the point is that sometimes not only did so-and-so offend you, but then you got to go forgive the jerk. You know, I mean, that's sort of like a double whammy, right? And so you're better off just not get offended in the first place because it spares you from having to go eat crow the second time. You see what I'm saying? And so the point is that we're better off just to not get offended and have to skip all the eat crow stage later, because you know you're going to have to. So what you have to do is learn how to treat people as if they are captured, not evil.
You're stepping on my toes.
I know. It must be the evening for it, okay?
Yes. Get my feet up.
Yeah. Well, you know what happens is when I get into this particular mode, I usually go home and the Lord beats me up for about 2 hours, you know. My house burns down or something happens because, you know, you can't...
Well, he's going to be beating me up too. So.
Well, that's it. Okay. Well, you won't be alone. Yeah.
He told me about that book, The Bait of Satan.
Yeah.
And I'm reading it
yeah.
right now, and it's all about the fence.
Yeah, yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, The Bait of Satan. Bevere is the guy's name. One of the best books in that area I've ever read. The Bait, B-A-I-T, of Satan. And the writer's name is Bevere, B-E-V-E-R-E. Some little old lady gave me that and said I ought to read it. Might have been one of you, I don't know. It's right. So the point is that once I understand how it is that God wants me to behave, and always it's contradictory to my nature. It's always contradictory to my nature because... if it wasn't contrary to my nature, I wouldn't need a Savior, but I do. So the point is that once I realize that, and then I realize when I've like done, you know, when I've backed over the guy in my truck, and then I got to get out and save him and take him to the hospital and all that kind of stuff and pay the bill and all this sort of thing. And after a while, I realize, if I not backed over him, I could have spared myself a lot. Then after a while, I decide I just won't back over the guy. I'm just going to treat him like a psych patient, you know. All right. The guy's just an idiot. What can I do about that? You know, I'll just move on. We used to tell all my kids my money went to Texas A&M. And we used to tell Aggie jokes. And one of the favorite Aggie jokes is about the Aggies that went out hunting and they accidentally shot their buddy. And so they brought him to the hospital and they were working on him. And finally the doctor came out and said, well... we saved him, but it'd have been a whole lot better if he hadn't field dressed him before he brought him in.
That sounds like one of those Aggie jokes.
But we just get in such a habit of field dressing our enemies, you know. And then we go, oh, I shouldn't have done it. We drag him to the hospital and ask God to save him. And at any rate, I've gone to preaching or something. Let me move on.
It's okay. You're preaching pretty good.
Verse 6, if a fire breaks out and spreads to thorn bushes, so that stacked grain or the standing grain of the field itself is consumed, then he who started the fire shall surely make restitution. Now, you think about these fires that are started up in the mountains of California or and out in the woods and stuff like that and spread to Denver, whatever. If a man gives his neighbor money or goods to keep for him, and it is stolen from the man's house, if his thief is caught, he shall pay double. If the thief is not caught, then the owner of the house shall appear before the judges to determine whether he laid his hands on his neighbor's property. So if I loan you something and it gets stolen, then they catch the thief has to make it good. But if they don't catch the thief, then it is appropriate to ascertain about whether or not I was in collusion with this. And I am responsible for your missing goods because you loaned it to me and I borrowed it. For every breach of trust, whether it is for ox or for donkey or sheep or clothing or any lost thing about which one says, this is it, the case of both parties shall come before the judges. He whom the judges contemn shall pay double to his neighbor. If the man gives his neighbor a donkey or an ox or a sheep or an animal for him to keep, and it dies or is hurt or is driven away while no one is looking, an oath before the Lord shall be made by the two of them that he has not laid his hands on his neighbor's property, and its owner shall accept it, and he shall not make restitution. So if it is proven that the man who borrowed the thing had nothing to do with its being missing, then he's not held liable for the penalty. Doesn't mean he isn't held liable for the donkey. If it's actually stolen from him, he shall make restitution to its owner. So if they steal your donkey, while I borrowed it, then I owe it to you, but I don't have to pay you double if I wasn't in collusion with the theft. If it's all torn to pieces, let him bring it as evidence, and he shall not make restitution for what has been torn to pieces. In other words, you give him back a donkey replacement, but you don't have to pay the restitution, the penalty, the double. One of the things the Bible tells us is that full restitution is double. Sometimes it's more than double, but it's at least double. And if you go to Isaiah 40, where the Lord announces, remember the first 39 chapters of Isaiah are about the judgment on Israel, and they correspond to the 39 books of the Old Testament. The next 27 chapters of Isaiah are about the coming of the kingdom of God and the redemption of Israel, and they correspond to the 27 books of the New Testament, just in number. Okay? But in Isaiah 40, which is the gateway into the second half, he says, comfort, O comfort my people. Naham, anaham is the Hebrew. Comfort, O comfort my people, and tell them that I, even the Lord, will pay double for them. Meaning I'm going to make restitution for their sins. I will pay double.
Do you think that the Old Testament judges, when they were making decisions, they would say, according to Exodus 22:6 or whatever, or they just used their divine wisdom?
No, I think that if they were godly judges and the people had godly lawyers, that's exactly what they did.
So they would like quote it?
Yeah. Well, when you have something in the Bible called a lawyer, it has nothing to do with what we would call a lawyer today. A lawyer is a person who was expert in the law. They were a person who knew these 613 inside and out, and the case law surrounding them, as in the case of so-and-so, and they quote some scripture where this or that happened, or as in the case of so-and-so. You know, and remember what God did to David because of Bathsheba is my text for why I think this person here ought to make this particular restitution for having committed adultery with this man's wife. So yeah, this is the law. So a lawyer, when Jesus was talking to lawyers and scribes are people who wrote for a living because the common man didn't write. So if you were going to build a building and you wanted so much as a laundry list of the stuff that you needed to buy and whatever, you'd go to the scribe and you'd tell the scribe and he would put all this together for you. If you wanted a will done, you'd go to the scribe. A lawyer was someone who was expert in the Torah law, and he would appeal to the judge. Now, if the judges were unjust, you know, they would do whatever. So, like, for instance, if a just judge said, okay, as in the case of Naboth, who had a vineyard and it was stolen by the king, and the king, well, whatever, so this is what it shall be, you know, what it be. But yeah, they would quote this. We don't have to memorize these, as it were, but we should read these and understand them. And, you know, if we read them enough in our lifetime, we soon get a feel for what's restitution. So if I borrow something from Margie and it gets misplaced, I can't find it, or whatever, I need to be in a hurry to buy her a replacement. And she may say, oh no, you don't need to do that, but you know, that's all grace on her part. I need to make a replacement for that. And if it is significant, I may need to make more than just a replacement for it. Which is one of the reasons why we're encouraged to neither be a borrower or a lender. If it is actually stolen from him, he shall make restitution to its owner. So, if it is all torn to pieces, let him bring it as evidence. He shall not make restitution for it has been torn to pieces. In other words, he has to give the man back a replacement donkey, but he doesn't have to pay the additional restitution. If a man borrows anything from his neighbor or is injured or dies while its owner is not with it, then he shall make full restitution. So if Bob brings his lawnmower over and we go to cutting my grass, and as we're going along, Bob runs over a rock with his lawnmower, help me cut my grass, he tears up his lawnmower, I'm not liable because the owner was with it. But if he gives it to me and then goes back and I go cutting the grass, and when he gets it back, the blades all went, I'm liable because the owner wasn't there to manage or steward this. So if he comes over and he's doing this, he's responsible for his own stuff while he's there. And if we wind up misusing it and we bend his post hole digger, but he's there to oversee it, then I'm not liable. That's what he's saying. Does it make sense? Okay. If the owner is with it, while his owner is not with it, he should make full restitution. If the owner is with it, he should not make restitution. If it is hired, it came for its hire. Now, so if I pay him $100 to rent something from him, And then in the course of using it, wear and tear, you know, comes upon it or it gets broken. It comes for the sake of its hire. The higher price was supposed to include the fact that it would come back diminished. You know, you could get into a civil claim that it was, you were not supposed to be doing this to tear up your concrete. You know, gas-powered postal diggers were not for breaking up concrete, and therefore it was misused, and therefore there's damages. But that's where you go to. If I'm using it in regular dirt to make post holes and whatever, and it binds up or whatever, it comes for its hire. Okay, so he who starts a fire is liable for its damages. He who fails in fiduciary responsibility is liable. Breach of trust can be a liable offense, but if the trustee is not negligent, there is no liability. The loss of borrowed goods makes one liable to the degree that the borrower is negligent. If the owner maintains control, the borrower is not liable. Animals hired out under the owner's control are not responsible to the one who hires them. So, you know, if you brought your oxen over and plow my field and one of your oxen dies and you're there, it's your ox. Okay, so we're seeing kind of the pattern here. If a man seduces a virgin who's not engaged and lies with her, he must pay a dowry for her to be his wife. You've heard me say this many times. In the Bible, the penalty for sexual behavior between two unmarried people is marriage. The penalty is marriage. When two unmarried people have sex, they are married before God. If one of them is married, it's adultery, and the penalty is different. If her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the dowry for a virgin. So it is not at all uncommon down through history for Romeo and Juliet to elope, and once they have consummated, there's not a whole lot their families can do about it. So it is not at all uncommon down through history for a couple of young people to marry themselves in this particular manner. One of the things that comes to mind is the situation with Shechem and Dinah, where Jacob's daughter Dinah was taken to a party with Hamor's son Shechem. Took her to bed, and it's not at all clear that she was felt the victim in this. She wound up later being married to him as his wife. If the father had said, no, I will not accept this, then he would have had to pay the dowry, but he wouldn't have had to marry her. So if Dinah had been saying to her father, I don't want to be around this beast, he raped me, then Jacob would have not agreed to the marriage. You see what I'm saying? So it's elopement. Two couple of teenagers elope and consummate. It sort of puts the parents in a bad place because a marriage has occurred. This is what's happening.
When David's son raped his
half sister,
and then David did nothing.
David is all kinds of responsible for what happened in that scenario, and he paid for it in spades with civil war. Now, when Amnon wanted his half-sister Tamar, she begged him not to do that, but when he did anyway, then she begged him to do the honorable thing and marry her. And she said, go to my father, he will not deny my hand, and then we can be married.
Our father.
Yeah, our father, right. And we can be married. David's lack of dealing with it is part of what caused Absalom to rise up against him and have caused civil war. David was like a lot of fathers. They fail to deal with their children in their offense. And, sometimes you throw your hands up and you go, what do I do? Which one do I shoot? You know, do I shoot this son or that son? You know, his failure to deal with it cost him.
Even though the father could, if the daughter had sex with the guy and they were married, and if the father said, no, I don't want her to marry, wasn't she looked at as damaged goods at that point?
She would have been, yeah. But that wasn't...
Really, there wasn't as much choice about whether to allow the...
Oh, I don't know. You might be rather damaged goods in your father's house than have to live in a rapist home with him as his wife.
That's true.
And damaged goods are not necessarily goods that never get married again.
Yeah.
You have to remember, these people weren't as puritanical as we are. They really weren't.
Yeah.
Okay, so, and they would have, if you look at our puritanical history, we have a history, for instance, of casting aspersions on people who are bastard children, even though it's no fault of their own. Or we talk about someone who's been raped as if they're damaged goods or whatever. These people don't go anywhere near that far with that sort of thing. They don't have those kinds of sensitivities. It's kind of our Calvinistic haughtiness that says, if I have nothing bad happen to me, it's an evidence of what a moral person I am. But if something bad happens to me, it's evidence of moral flaw somewhere under the surface. Well, that shows itself up sometimes in these cases of women being treated badly because they managed to get raped. Now, there's going to be, we haven't got to this yet, but there's going to be conversation about if a woman gets raped and she fails to cry out, there's one way to deal with it, verse, is if she cries out or could have cried out. It talks about, for instance, if she gets raped in the country or in the field where no one can hear her, it's one thing. But if she gets raped in the city and could have cried out and didn't, it's another thing. So they make a distinction there between whether or not she was going with this or not going with this. Because it's funny how very often after the fact, consensual sex becomes rape when certain things enter in, like you get caught. We constantly have this dispute in our television today and in the news about some girl saying this guy raped her and he's claiming it's consensual sex. I mean, don't we see that constantly? We got basketball players having sex with girls who may have been having sex with him in hopes of getting hold of his money. And when that didn't work out, then she's crying rape and he's saying, no, it's consensual. And then you get into this, he said, she said, and, you know, I mean, so some famous people have been through that. So he who seduces an unmarried woman must marry her unless the father refuses to allow it. In that case, the dowry must be paid to restore her honor. This has actually happened when Pharaoh captured Sarah. Okay? She was captured and Sarah was... of course, Sarah was never physically assaulted because he didn't have her long enough. He had to get her into shape for his bed. She didn't smell good enough. She wasn't soft enough. She had to have all this treatment stuff. But when Pharaoh realized what he had done, he paid. Now, this is not the law of Moses. Pharaoh paid an extraordinary dowry price back to Sarah to restore her honor. So, I mean, basically someone could say, hey, I heard Pharaoh took your wife, you know, whatever. And he said, well, look at all this flocks and stuff like that. He gave this back to say that she was not at fault. And that's, they said, oh, okay. Well, if you lived in that culture, if you lived in that culture, they would look at us and say, "What weird people these people are," because of the way we do things. So, it's easy for us. But it's easy for us to look at these people and say, "Well, I wouldn't have done that." But then it's also important for us to remember that they didn't grow up in Judeo-Christian teaching, and they didn't grow up in our cultural adjustments and all this kind of stuff and our modern sensitivity. In our world today, you can go around the globe and you can find very, very dedicated Christians that have culturally different ways of looking at some of these things that are vastly different. A simple example is the Christians in some part of the country who are polygamous by culture and are just go right along with it without considering it non-biblical at all, and we really can't fault that. It is only here in the West that we have this heavy emphasis on one man and one wife at a time. But that is not, you can't back that biblically. Paul said in the first century that if a man wants to be a bishop, that he should be the husband of one wife. So what he's saying is if you have more than one wife, you can't be a bishop. You can't be an elder because you don't have time to manage the household of God and take care of all that family. So even Paul is acknowledging a polygamous environment among Christians and saying that if the person's got more than one wife, he is not qualified to be an elder. Now, what some people do with that is to say if he's been divorced, he's not qualified. What they do, because they don't want to acknowledge the polygamous implications of that scripture, is they say, oh, he must mean if he's ever been divorced. And so rather than acknowledge the polygamy, they would rather beat the snot out of some person who's been divorced and say, you therefore cannot be a priest among us. Now, this came up locally here in town Charles Stanley, who preached for years and years and years, and I'm sorry, Mr. Stanley, but on the tape, but preached for years and years and years that a person who was divorced could not be a pastor. And then his wife separated from him, and it caused a conundrum down at the church. And they said, well, she hasn't divorced him, they're just separated. And then, when she then filed divorce, now they were in a real pickle, because he was on tape as saying, you couldn't do this, and they worked it out somehow or another. I don't know the details, but they come to some conclusion that it didn't apply to him. I don't care. I mean, it's okay, because it was never a problem with me to begin with. But the point is that we sometimes bend these interpretations in ways that they don't need to be bent.
It's almost like God is saying, use your brain. I mean, he's saying, you can't use I don't know as an excuse.
Well, he is saying use your brain, but he's saying use your brain after it's been educated by my brain.
Right, and before you do anything.
Yeah, and before you do anything. Well, yeah, that's right. But what he's saying is if you learn my ways and my precepts and whatever, and then you operate on those things, you're going to be fine.
Right.
You're going to be fine. So if someone comes to me and they go, well, you know, this person should never be allowed to teach class because they've been divorced or something like that. I'm going to go, you know, I don't know. I know where you might be coming from that, but it's not from the Bible. You might be coming from some doctrinal statement of some group you used to belong to, but it's not from the Bible. So we would rather beat on divorcees than to acknowledge that polygamy was operating in Paul's day among Christians. So, moving on. Wayne's been wrong before, tape. When Shechem, son of Hamor, violated Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, this same kind of principle comes into play here. Jacob accepted that Dinah should marry Shechem and was prepared to receive the bride price for her and provide a dowry. And so Dinah was moved in with Shechem. When the brothers went to burn the place down, it says clearly that they went and grabbed Dinah from Shechem. She was already living there with her husband. And so if Jacob felt like that it was a good thing to let Dinah and Shechem be married, even though the way that the marriage was consummated was, you know, outside the pale of good form, he must have felt like that Shechem and Dinah cared for each other. There was, because if his daughter had said, "Daddy, don't make me marry that beast who raped me at a party," he would have declined that. You know, I mean, Jacob's not that callous. He's guilty of a lot of things, but not that. So, you see the point. So, when Simeon and Levi get those people in a bad medical condition by having them circumcise themselves without anesthesia, and 3 days later when they're in their fevers go in and kill every man, woman, and child, Jacob curses them and their violent anger and their violent nature because they put the whole tribe at risk. They have violated the covenant by seducing these people and being circumcised and then slaughtering and all of that. They cause all the people around them to bring cast aspersions on Jacob and his people and maybe even put a posse together to come after them. And they've got to flee into the night, and Rachel dies on the way. And Jacob, in the 49th chapter of Genesis, when he's blessing his sons, curses those two and their offspring. And it's very interesting to me that the people of Levi become the official butchers of Israel. They have a temperament for it. Doesn't make them bad people. People of Simeon disappear into Judah. Just disappear. All right. You should not allow sorceress to live. Anyone who seeks wisdom from dark places, Satan, the dead, any of that sort of thing. Anybody involved in horoscopes, astrology, seances, mediums, all that sort of thing, is seeking God in places, in demonic places. And God says you need to execute those people because they invite Satan among you. You know, the thing about God is that he often cares about things we don't care about. And sometimes we care about things he doesn't care about. And we just keep wanting God to straighten up and get with it and go with our program. But what we really need to do is to consider seriously that when God doesn't like something, then we really ought to think about not liking it ourselves or tolerating it. And when God is gracious about something, we ought to think about that too. So if God is gracious toward people but hates sin, then we should sense that as well. If he's ungracious toward people who refuse to abandon their sin and decides to nuke those people, then we need to understand he is nuking them because they have refused to abandon their sin, not because the fact that they were sinners to begin with that's not what caused it. So I might think that someone else is unclean for something that they're doing, but captured. And so I should love that particular person, protecting myself from them or whatever, but maybe hate what they do and maybe speak against what they do. But if someone is sort of like violently imposing that sin upon me or others, then I may resist that person with all the fury of God, because now it's not a matter of me loving sinners and hating sin. It's a matter of somebody trying to push that sin down my throat. Whoever lies with an animal shall surely be put to death. This is another thing that we don't do a ton of in our society that used to be a big hit. Not that long ago. I could tell you stories, but I won't. It's a mixed crowd. He who sacrifices to any god other than the Lord alone shall be utterly destroyed. Oh, okay, now, so here's something he's serious about. You shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. So, idolaters we stone, aliens we embrace. You shall not afflict any widow or orphan. Ah, widows and orphans we embrace. If you afflict him at all, and if he does cry out to me, I will surely hear his cry, and my anger will be kindled, and I will kill you with the sword. I will destroy your economy. I will take away your good name in the earth. I will cause your military to fall into disuse, and I will bring upon you every curse that you can imagine upon the land. America. Because you abuse the alien among you and fail to care for your orphan and widows. My anger will be kindled. I will kill you with the sword. Your wives shall become widows and your children fatherless. So now we get some miscellaneous rules to follow. Sorcery and witchcraft are capital offenses. Sex with animals is a capital offense. Bestiality introduces new diseases in the human species, by the way. And unfortunately, it's too late for a lot of that because it's already happened a lot. Sacrificing to a false god is a capital offense. Oppressing an alien or a widow is a serious crime. God will punish those who oppress widows and orphans. Your wives will become widows and your children become orphans. What does that remind you of? Principle of sowing and reaping. If you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you are not to act as a creditor to him. You shall not charge him interest. If you ever take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, you shall return to him before the sun sets, for that is his covering. It is his cloak for his body. What shall he sleep in? And it comes about that when he cries out to me and I hear him, while he's cold and shivering in the night, I will hear him, for I am gracious. You shall not curse God, nor curse a ruler of your people. Oops. You should not curse a ruler of your people. Oops. You shall not delay the offering from your harvest or your vintage. Oops, tithing. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. You shall do the same with your oxen and your sheep. Oops. It shall be with its mother 7 days. On the eighth day you shall give it to me. You shall be holy men to me. Therefore you shall not eat the flesh torn to pieces in the field. No roadkill. You shall throw it to the dogs. So we must not lend to the poor person interest. If we see a poor person in need, we just give him the money. If we give it to him and he pays us back, don't accept interest. We must not keep their cloak overnight. Now, here's what happens. Most of the housing for people of this era would have been either a one-room tent or a one-room house in a village. And in that one-room tent or one-room house, you may have a little orn or a little cooking place, or that may actually be outside. If it's a one-room house, stone, you may have a barbecue on top of the house. But you wouldn't do a lot of heavy cooking in the house because it's where you sleep. I mean, it's, you know, and there's not many windows and the whole place would just be smoke all over the place. You might have a little fire to warm yourself up if you have the makings of a good chimney. But what happens at night is that because it's a one-room house, everyone gathers together and takes their cloaks and lays it over everyone so that we can all stay warm in the cool of the night. And then if something happens that somebody knocks on the door in the middle of the night, you say, go away and come back. If I get up, I'll make everybody else cold. So if I get up, I got to put my cloak on and come answer your door. Remember, Jesus told that story. So if I take your cloak as a lever, what do you call it?
Deposit.
Says a deposit or something. For a loan that I make you, I've got to give it back to you at night so that you can at least cover yourself and your family with it. Because if I hear you or your children, him or his children, crying out to me in the night because they're cold, I'm coming after you. So in all of that, what we see is the spirit of lending and giving money to poor people. That cloak represents what that plus it's what keeps the body temperatures contained underneath the pile of cloaks so that everybody can stay warm. Because you're not going to have a raging fire inside of a tent. You're not going to have a big fire inside of a small house.
Collateral.
There you go. That's the word I was looking for. They need it for nightly covering for them and their families. We must not curse God or any ruler of our people. To curse a ruler of our people is the same as cursing God. It puts them in the same breath. That's all that conversation we have about reviling. Reviling is even back then seen as a sin. Now, once again, these things came down from God. They didn't come down, these weren't man-made rules. Part of the thing of it is that many of these things reflect principles and truths that many of our Christian people do not understand because they've never read it. People don't read the Old Testament. They don't see that it has anything to say to them. They're not doing what we're doing, which is sitting here and parsing this, you know, and taking it apart and informing ourselves to what it means. And so consequently they go, well, surely it's okay to hate a bad man, isn't it? Right? We can take a bad man. We've got a bad man who's, you know, governor of our state or something, and he's doing all the bad. Surely we can revile him. And the Bible says, surely not. In fact, we're told that Michael the archangel refused to revile Satan when he went to wrestle with him over the body of Moses, but simply said, the Lord rebuke you, Satan, and moved on. So the point is that reviling is a sin.
Think about how we feel about interest rates for the poor that have made unwise choices and have filed bankruptcy. I mean, that pays them in the nose.
There's always a balance between the just deserts of someone who's been foolish and grace. And I think that it would be, if you have a son who's squandered an inheritance, you're not required to keep giving him an inheritance to squander. So if he is a squanderer, then you don't have to keep giving him money. he may take that position. He may say, look, Father, the Bible says that, you know, you should whatever.
Yeah.
And that's just not true, because the Bible speaks about stewardship. So what were you talking about using your head a while ago? You've got the calls to stewardship versus the calls to things like grace. All right, we must be willing to tithe quickly and gladly. The firstborn of our children belong to God. The firstborn of our animals belong to God. The first thing of everything belongs to God. P.S. Do not eat roadkill.
The point about, you know, first God or our rulers, you know, that's one thing that really bothers me today. I don't agree with any of our current president's policy, but he is the president. And I think that's what's happened to Congress. They don't have any respect for
you. There's no honor there.
There is none, that is so sad to see. I mean, he should be respected because he's the president of this country.
Yeah, the thing of it is, Stan, is that those congressmen are a direct reflection of the people they serve. And they stand there, and, you know, Mitch McConnell, my senator from Kentucky, he stands and says all these things that he says, and sometimes what he says is respectful and sometimes it's not. But these kind of people who get up and do all this kind of stuff, knowing that back home there's 10,000 people going, give him hell, Mitch, give him hell, you know. Once again, we watched the movie Lincoln the other night. And if you saw the scenes in the Congress where they were arguing to each other about stuff, I mean, they were calling each other everything but a milk cow. You know, I mean, they were just all over each other with stuff. And, you know, so we have a long and colorful history with all that sort of thing. In fact, the more you study this carefully, the more you realize the fragile nature of our democracy. The fact that it ever stood at all is just plain miraculous. You can hate the deed, but you have to respect the person.
Yeah.
Love the person, care for the person. So I might think that many of the policies of our president are muddy-headed in their thinking, illogical in their thinking. They're based in a socialism that will only lead us to destruction, as been evidenced by every socialism that ever rose up, including the one that caused the demise of the British Empire. And I can believe that those thinkings and those patterns and those principles and stuff like that are just abjectly wrong, and that they will lead us down a path of destruction, and we should do whatever we can legally and politically and whatever, and on our knees to make those policies reverse themselves. I have to do that knowing full well, though, that when we get the capitalism in place, it's got to be a compassionate capitalism, and it can't be a capitalism that just says make the rich richer and screw the poor, because that is all too often the capitalism that is offered in opposition to the socialism. The people who lead our Senate and our Congress from the far right have so little compassion you couldn't put it in the thimble that comes out of their mouth. You know, their basic thing is, let the poor work harder. You know, well, you know, that's all very interesting until you've got a whole bunch of those poor that have college educations, they're desperately trying to find a job and can't find one. And when it turns out to be your son, you know whether he's lazy or not. So, it's all pretty interesting there. Exodus 23, we're going to move on for a little bit. You shall not bear a false report. Do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. So whenever we tell a lie on somebody, whether it is either intentional to destroy them or passing along gossip that just isn't true, that we haven't snoped and scoped, we are in serious violation of God's commands. If people understood this, they would only pass about 5% of what they get on the internet along, because the other 95% of it is almost never accurate or true. It's almost always spun in a certain direction.
Same with our political races. I mean, have struggled to find out what is the truth about.
Yeah.
And it's so
hard. It's called spin. And we become a people of spin. And it's I remember when spin was a partner of Marty. Spin and Marty. But now what happens is spin is how we spin everything. And so truth has fallen by the wayside. You shall not bear a false report, do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not follow a multitude in doing evil, nor shall you testify and dispute so as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice. So a PAC, a political action committee, that gathers itself together for the purposes of perverting justice, no matter how they justify it, you know, well, we've got to get the SOBs out so we can get our SOBs in, because our SOBs are better SOBs than their SOBs. That's not a justification for swift boating somebody, whether even if it's true, but much less if it's not. If you, nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute. So in the process of being gracious to the poor, you cannot be partial to them. It goes back to what I said about a no-good Nick son who has wasted what you've given him. The command to be gracious does not mean you should give him more to waste, because the command of stewardship has to balance that. Do you remember the movie Parenthood with Steve Martin? And you remember that Steve Martin's father-in-law was Jason Robards. And he had another son who was the guy who played Amadeus. He was the curly-headed guy. And his other son was a kind of a con man, just an inveterate con man. And he was always getting into some deal or another, and his father had bailed him out of one after another. And it gets down toward the end of the movie, and this kid gets himself in trouble again. And his father is sitting on his porch one day, and a bunch of cars, cars fly by, and they throw the kid out the back, and he rolls down in the street and whatever. So his enemies have beaten the snot out of him and whatever, and they've given him so long to pay his debts and whatever. So he goes to his father head in hand, he's just shaking, and he said, you know, I really need your help and whatever the case may be. And so his father says, I got to think about this. This is Jason Robards. And this part of the movie, he's doing a lot of thinking about a lot of things. So he finally sits down and he says to the kid, I'm going to help you. And the kid, I forget his name, he just takes a big sigh of relief. He's like, oh God, you're going to bail me out. And he said, here's what we're going to do. He said, I'm going to pay off your debts. And then Monday morning, you're going to come to the store with me, and you're going to go to work for me. And you're going to work for me 40 to 45 hours a week, he said, some speech. And you're going to do this, you're going to do this, and you're going to pay me back. And you're going to do this until someday, when we get you straightened out, you're going to take over the family store and what it. And the kid looks at him like, that wasn't what I was really thinking about. And the kid says to his father, that's a great plan. And let's say his father's name is Charles Jones. He said, now, I have heard about an opportunity in Bolivia where I can make a really quick score. And if you could just loan me some money, I could go and do that. And if that doesn't work out, then I'll come back and we'll put the Charlie Jones plan in place. And Jason Robards looks at him and says, how much do you need? He says, oh, I don't know. He said, would 1,000 do it? He said, imminently. So the kid takes 1,000, goes off to Bolivia, and he leaves behind his son, who is a mixed breed child with curly hair. He said, what about the kid, whatever his name is? He said, oh, I hadn't thought about the kid. He said, do you think, and Jason Robards says, don't worry about it. We got it covered. Because Jason Robards, who was a bigot at the beginning of the movie, has come to love this little kid. So he knows this kid is not, he's not going to. So he gives him his 1,000 and let him goes off and we're going to get killed or something like that. But it's a very interesting story, a very interesting scene where it sort of plays out this whole thing about, you know, are you going to... So instead of Jason Robards paying off all this guy's debts, he's going to give this guy 1,000, he's going to go off and try to run from it and see what happens. I mean, in all likelihood, he's going to wind up dead. But there's not more he can do. Huh?
Parenthood.
Parenthood.
That's Parenthood?
That was in Parenthood.
Yeah, towards the end of the movie.
Yeah. Parenthood. I forget the name of this kid. He played Mozart in Amadeus. Curly hair.
He was also in Animal House.
He might have been. I didn't see Animal House. But yeah, it's got real curly hair.
You missed it.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. I didn't. That was in my religious period when I was. Okay. Let me get through this one section here. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, Tom something, that's his name. His name's Tom.
Halsey.
Yes, Tom Halsey. Halsey. Yeah, something like that. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, you should surely return it to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying helpless under its load, you shall surely refrain leaving it to him. You shall surely release it with him. You shall not pervert the justice due your needy brother in his dispute. Keep far from a false charge. Do not kill the innocent or the righteous, for I will not acquit the guilty. You shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of the just. You shall not oppress a stranger, since you yourselves know the feelings of a stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Some translations use the word alien there. Moses makes a clarion call for the absolute honesty with all men. We must not gossip or lie about another person. We must not conspire with another person to bear false witness, nor should we follow the crowd in false witness about someone. That means when someone comes to you and says, "Did you hear so-and-so and so-and-so?" that we have an obligation not just to jump in and say, "Yeah, yeah," but we need to say, "Is that really true? I did not think that was true. Are you sure that's right? I heard a different way, or I don't know if that to be true." We must not show partiality to the poor or the needy. Always tell the truth. Treat your enemy fairly and with justice. Return his wandering donkey and save it from harm. If you see him, his donkey, you know, lying in a ditch under his burden, take the pack off the donkey and let him up. Even though the guy's not there to do it for himself, you gotta have compassion on the donkey, even though he's his enemy's donkey. Do not gang up on the innocent. I am their protector. Take no bribes. Never pervert justice. Treat the alien among you kindly, because you were once aliens in Egypt. You should know how unfair that feels. Okay, we will start with verse 10 next time.
You know, I wonder sometimes when I read this, and I'm thinking after our discussion last week, that must have been some conversation that God and Moses had to get all to stand.
It was over time. It wasn't like...
It was over time, but you had to... I mean, it would appear that Moses would say, "Now, wait a minute, God, you mean it's really like this?"
Yeah, Well,
we think it's been like this, but do we have to do it this way?
Yeah, well, I think it's a good point, Stan, and I think what we should think about is a little bit about what that means. Okay, first of all, most of us think we know how we would respond if we were sitting around with God. But the truth of us is most of us would be in a very different state of mind. We would be not speaking a whole lot, listening very carefully, awestruck at what's going on, and any sort of loose kind of impediment of moral thinking in our background would be aside.
Yeah.
And we'd be going... Exactly what did you mean by that, sir? You know, and you know, we wouldn't be thinking certain kinds of ways.
Yeah.
Okay.
I agree.
Now, Moses and God were Well, Moses and God were friends. What I'm saying is there would be initially an attitude difference.
Yeah.
Okay. Then the discussion can happen, and Moses could say, "Well, gosh, God, I didn't realize that. We always kind of thought that's the way this is." And God would say, "No, the reason why it's not this way is this and this and this." And so God could easily set and informed Moses with the context of all he's thinking. And Moses is just not bringing all of that quite down, at least not in one piece. Because remember, this has got to be succinct writing. Now, if it's me, I'm saying God said this, and we had this conversation, it went on like this, and I said this, he said that, and whatever, you got 9 pages. You know, if it's Moses, he says this and moves on.
Here's one line.
That's right. And so...
It's just fascinated me now reading this.
Yeah.
Think about Moses and God sitting there.
Yeah.
Putting these down.
Well, Moses and God were friends, too. Remember that because Moses and God were friends, there's a conversational level that can happen when Moses and God are brand new. The first time Moses and God meet each other, Moses is on his knees with his shoes off, and God is telling him to go to Egypt and do this kind of stuff. And Moses is going, how can I do that? And God's going, well, I'll be patient with you for a while. Stick your hand in your chest, come out, leprosy, and do this and do that. And after a while, he's going, Moses, I said go. You know, and got it. You know, and then they get down the road at the end the first night, and the angel shows up to kill Moses because he's uncircumcised. Or a son, because he's uncertain. So, I mean, their relationship is much more adversarial and fragile at the beginning.
Yeah.
By the time he gets to coming down back and forth, and I mean, part of that change that's going on in him is that he's hanging around God, because all salvation is based in relationship, and all relationship is based in trust. So the point is that relationship modifies Moses and allows for further relationship.
Which is exactly what he wants to do with us.
Gosh, you think. Of course, that's right. That's exactly right. So,
great. That's interesting.
All righty. Any other comments?
Just thinking about their relationship, think how angry Moses had to be that he brought down the Ten Commandment tablets. That God wrote himself and threw them on the ground. Now that was an easy thing.
Well, and Moses had.
Did Aaron doing all that?
Yeah. I understand
brother,
it being mad, but God wrote that and carved them out and everything.
Yeah, it's.
Those first ten.
The Ten Commandments.
Yeah. I don't know, was it saying?
Yeah, it was the same. It says it was the same.
Because he said he was going to write. He wrote it on the second one, the same thing God did.
Yeah.
The false guy, God man, moved up the list.
Yeah. Well, the there's a lot in that. You have to think about, for instance, what does it say about the grace of God that Aaron winds up as the head of the priestly family?
Yeah.
Well, you have to think about that.
Wow.
You know, and you see David becoming this incredible. Figure of God's admiration in spite of all of that he went through. So what is it? What's the difference? Now, we see God striking Nadab and Abihu dead as a smacker, just consuming them in fire because they brought strange fire. And God tells Aaron, don't even mourn. Don't even go there. Don't rip your clothes, no nothing, no ashes. Don't mourn. So it's not that God is not capable of just squashing them like a bug. So he there's something in Aaron that Aaron's response to this causes God to forgive him and overlook it. Now we see Aaron getting in trouble again on up the road when he and Miriam are taking Moses to task over the fact that he married the Cushite woman. And God calls Moses, Aaron, and Miriam into the tent. And in that particular case, he dumps his load on Miriam. But he also forgives her and restores her. And, you know, Miriam's a kind of a queen bee. She has more going on in Israel than Moses' wife does. Moses' wife is always that foreign woman he married. You know, so it's interesting to see what God values and who he forgives and who he doesn't forgive and try to figure out why. You know, why would he just squash Nadab and Abihu, Aaron's sons, his first two sons, just incinerate them? Because they offered strange fire. And I think that what it always comes back to is, it's not so much what they did, it's what's in their heart. It always comes back to that. Because even though Aaron did a bad thing, his heart seems to be toward God. And even though David did some bad things, his heart seemed to be toward God. On the other hand, Nadab and Abihu did bad things, but their heart does not appear to be on God. And so God just goes... So it's not a matter of whether or not we do bad things. It's a matter of what's in our heart on top of that. So consequently, when we get to burying people that have done bad things, we should trust that only God knows what's in their heart. And just go from there. So can Jeffrey Dahmer have repented like he said he did in prison? And is he forgiven in heaven? Is Nebuchadnezzar in heaven because he repented to the Lord? Those are two people who by historically demonstrated, have done extraordinary bad things. And yet, both of them counted on the grace of God. And who am I to say whether they're or not? I expect to see either one of them there if their heart is as good as it looked like it might have been in the change, in the process. So, at any rate, somebody pray us out.